From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, John Goerda has become synonymous with Milwaukee history, but today we'll talk with him about his own history. Then we talk with the medical director of the Frederick and Medical College of Wisconsin Inclusion Health Clinic, the first here to focus on the needs of the LGBTQ community.
If we want to improve the health of this community, we want to provide a place where we can give people a welcoming and affirming environment and also the expertise that they need to get healthcare that will improve their overall health and outcomes.
And we'll chat with the painter Mark Chagall's granddaughter about his circus works that are currently on view in Milwaukee. She says seeing them never gets old.
I recognize his gestures. I recognize his love for humanity. It's just quite formidable and an experience each time.
Lake Effect Weekend is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect Weekend from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North. Historian John Goerda is the go-to source for all things Milwaukee history. He's authored several books on the city's history, including Milwaukee, A City of Neighborhoods, Cream City Chronicles, and The Making of Milwaukee, which became a Milwaukee PBS series of the same name. Goerda is also a regular feature on the public television series Around the Corner with John McGivern, where he explores parts of the state beyond the city. It may seem that John Goerda was tailor-made for this work, but his journey has been much more fitful than you might imagine. Goerda opens up about his life in a profile featured in this month's Milwaukee magazine, and he joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about his work and how he came to it.
Place has always been important to me. I kind of imprint on places, and Milwaukee obviously is a place where I was born and grew up. Has had a huge impact on me. Some of the kind of the mores, the folkways in Milwaukee, especially growing up in the South Side, and especially when you get kind of outside the South Side, you realize people look at the South Side as somewhat different. I went to Marquette High School and remember being asked where my viaduct pass was, you know, because this was sort of foreign territory to a degree, and looked down on to some degree as well, which of course made me react in the other direction, you know, to be quite proud and perhaps for a time even a South Side chauvinist, which I proudly claimed. But I think more generally, some of the things that in Milwaukee that really had an impact on me were there's a strong sense of history in this town, and you see it in the architecture, you see it in the heritage, you see it in the festivals. And both my folks, my dad was second-generation Polish, my mom was second-generation Norwegian, so they both spoke their languages, you know, so that kind of had an impact on me as well. And just the small-scale geography, especially of the South Side, you know, was something that I always, because I was raised in it, you know, something that was always very comfortable. You know, and that's something I still like about Milwaukee. It's very much a human scale city. If you want buzz, you know, if you want kind of the excitement, you know, 90 miles south, you know, it's pretty easy to reach Chicago. But I've liked that access, you know, to kind of the urban experience, but also the somewhat more manageable urban experience of Milwaukee. That's we do that well. Milwaukee does that nice sweet spot between large and small very well.
You know, you are so Milwaukee. You're so quintessentially Milwaukee. And yet I was surprised to learn that you left for a time for college.
Yeah, it was kind of, I went to Boston College, and the story there very simply is that Marquette High School is a Jesuit high school. BC is a Jesuit college, and BC was trying to broaden its geographic base. So 8 of us in my graduating class got scholarships, and I got a full ride. So that was a fairly easy decision to make. But Boston was a great town to be a college kid in back in the late 60s. You know, I remember seeing Joni Mitchell and Richie Havens and David Bromberg, other heroes at the time, in rooms not too much bigger than the studio. So,
you know, you described your experience as being kind of a fish out of water, and I think a lot of Midwesterners can identify with that. When you move to especially New England, but the East in general, it's very different. What did you think about Boston culturally?
It was Boston, and it was more generally the Northeast. They were about 4 years faster than any of us from Milwaukee, you know, came out there in terms of, you know, life experience and attitude. I really enjoyed Boston, the city itself, and I like the layers of history there. My last year in Boston, I lived in the North End, but since become quite gentrified. But back then it was probably 98% Italian. I was the only non-Italian probably within a four-block radius of where I lived. That was a lot of fun. I really liked that. And part of that was my own kind of gravitation toward things ethnic that I learned from Milwaukee. And part of it was kind of getting away from kind of the heady college atmosphere that is part of the college experience, but also getting away from kind of the more the more typical Eastern buzz, being something ethnic. That was a great experience.
You know, as you mentioned, Boston is a town that is very steeped in history. Mm-hmm. People might not think of Milwaukee as being quite steeped in that same history, and yet you bring that out so much in this city.
That's the big difference between Boston and Milwaukee, those two in particular. The overlay in Boston, the story, the dominant story is Yankee. It is the colonial period and the revolution. And that really drowns out the more recent ethnics. So you know the South Boston's Irish, you know the North End's Italian, you know there are a lot of other, Roxbury is African American, you know there are other groups there, but their voices are really muted in that historical conversation. In the case of the Midwest, and this really struck me very powerfully when I came home and began to get involved in history, the story is much more recent. The story is those industrial immigrants who began to arrive back in the 1860s, 70s especially, even earlier the Germans, 1830s. But it's a more recent story.
You know, you are a baby boomer. I think mm-hmm. that's how you'd be described.
Yeah, sure.
And you mention in the profile that, at least in the 1960s, you felt baby boomers were, not only ahistorical,
absolutely,
but anti-historical.
Absolutely.
Why do you say that?
Back in those years, it was the whole ethos of never trusting anybody over 30. We can change the world was kind of a mantra, and what that means is that the world as you inherited it was defective. And there was certainly, large and still are, large gaps, large problems. But the fact that we were, it was the counterculture, So there was a culture and the counterculture was established, obviously in opposition to it. So there was a sense that we needed to remake, all the institutions that we had inherited. And what that meant was we threw the baby out with the bathwater. There was just no interest whatsoever in history. And again, that's probably a Milwaukee influence kind of mindset for me. I mean, it was there, kind of subconscious as it may have been, but it was there. So that came out, when I began to think about history as story, especially. That became very powerful and very much a part of who I've been ever since.
And refinding the baby that was lost.
Absolutely, yeah. Throw the bathwater out. Bring the baby
bring
back.
The baby
let,
back.
Let it grow. Let it grow.
So, yeah, you mentioned going to college in Boston. You thought about becoming a poet,
mm-hmm.
and you kind of stumbled into this work.
Yeah, and I think the phrase I've used is came back to Milwaukee and all the poet jobs were taken, so that was not an option. You have to remember, the 60s were pretty woolly. Part of it was, again, that old line, if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. And for me, the real kind of a breakthrough there, and it was very lucky. Certainly, I describe myself as an accidental historian, and that's absolutely true. But a good friend, Frank Miller, was running a youth center on the South Side called the Journey House. Still there. It has grown by leaps and bounds. But that was, first of all, it got me out of my head, which was important for a lot of people in the 60s to kind of get out of, and got me in contact with real people in a real neighborhood setting. So we're working with largely an Anglo population of kids in the near South Side. We were on 16th and El Cesar Chavez in Washington. And it's a truism, but if you begin to orient yourself toward others, it will pull you out of yourself. I think that's extremely important. It was certainly important for me back then. But in terms of occupation, the breakthrough there was we were an agency with a staff of six and a budget of $45,000. So it was not even hand to mouth. It was hand to waistline or something. So we needed to kind of validate ourselves as worthy of funding. So a Vista volunteer named Byron Anderson, is now a retired librarian in DeKalb, Illinois. He and I pretty much on our own decided to do kind of what you call a case statement today. And Byron did the numbers and I did the history. And I have no idea why. I don't recall that being a conscious decision at all. And I began to run into all these intersections. Again, being a Southsider, I remember One aha moment was I was working at the County Historical Society, some Near South Side research materials, and there was the letterhead of a Polish student organization from UW back in the 20s, and my dad's name was on it. And I said, whoa, you know, this is, there's history here, and it's personal. You know, this is my story. This is where I came from. My grandparents had a hardware store on 32nd and Lincoln, and I'd constantly run into people who said, no, Gerda Hardware. You know, I bought nails from your grandpa. You know, so there was that very kind of a very visceral connection. So I began to see all these connections, you know, between my story, city story, America story, world story, and that story is history. That story is the past, and where we are in the present, where we'll be in the future, there's only one place it can come out of, and that's the past. So that became, you know, it wasn't quite the cartoon of the light bulb over the head, but it was pretty darn close. And that's, you know, that was 1971, so it's been a long time.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, you continued in this work, but you decided to go back and get your master's. Why was that?
As I explained to Carolyn Cott Washburn did the interview, and I'm glad she kept the line in, I did not know my ass from my elbow, and that was absolutely true. So an English major certainly will give you a great deal of kind of soul material, but it won't tell you how to do research. It won't give you much respect for evidence. You know, it's a whole somewhat different animal. So I knew if I wanted to stay in this field, and I did, you know, I was feeling, you know, just a strong, strong pull to history, that I would need not a credential. I need more skills, need more tools. So UWM, for financial reasons, was the most obvious choice. And I actually wasn't quite an audition, but I talked to urban affairs, history, sociology, and geography. And geography has a couple of really very sort of high-profile urbanists. Harold Mayer was one. He's my advisor. That guy knew everything. He knew everything. So it was geography became the obvious choice because what I was doing back then was pretty much neighborhoods, kind of this. What it became was the intersection of time and place, which is historical geography. And that became kind of still what I do. It's kind of the field that was closest to me. And ended up doing my master's thesis on Jones Island, which was another kind of a voyage of discovery. You got the little piece of real estate, you know, that is among the most obscure in Milwaukee, and nobody lives there. But it was a native settlement. It was a French-Canadian fur trading post. It was a Yankee shipbuilder's home and base of business. And most importantly, for 50 years, it was a fishing village. People from the Baltic Sea coast of Poland, a group called the Kashubes. And now it's, you know, tank farms and the sewage plant and the port of Milwaukee. So talk about change, you know, in one very small piece of geography. In a lot of ways, it's kind of a microcosm of the Milwaukee areas and the region's history. So that was I wouldn't call it fun, but as close to fun as research and writing get. So that whole experience, EWM, was very important for me. It gave me a respect for evidence, research tools, and a sense that I was part of the conversation. You know, call it a scholarly conversation, if you will, but the conversation of people who are exploring, asking questions, inquiring, and sort of bouncing things off each other, whether it's in print or in person. And that was very important.
You really have become the go-to source for history about Milwaukee, but you also do Around the Corner right. with John McGivern.
Mm-hmm.
And you do a lot of research about a variety of other places in the state. You know, when I think about kind of where you started and where you are now, when you're looking at these communities, which you might not know too much about to begin with, what is your research like now? How do you get into that?
First of all, I am as proud a Wisconsinite as I am a proud Milwaukeean. My mom's from Coon Valley, a small town up near La Crosse, raised on a dairy farm there. So I've always considered myself bi-coastal. I was raised on Lake Michigan, but not that far from the Mississippi. And we go out there every summer, so I always had a strong affinity, you know, for the Driftless area of Wisconsin. And would spend a lot of time canoeing, biking up north. So I've spent time in all 72 counties. And on the show, the Around the Corner show with John, we both agree that it's the best part-time job either of us has ever had. And this is the kind of stuff when I travel, I do it anyway. I try to figure out, poking around towns, kind of where they came from, kind of what the story is, you know, what the landmarks are. So the research in working on actually was working on Menasha, you know, just last week. We're doing Menasha this year for season 9. But the place I go is the Central Library Humanities Room downtown there on 9th, 814 West Wisconsin. And there are shelves, and I mean shelves, of histories of every county and community in the entire state of Wisconsin. So there's a broad shelf on Door County. You know, there's less on Portage County, but there's enough. You know, so that I go through those. Begin with most counties had histories done, a lot of them kind of commissioned, but they also had histories in there. Some go back to the 1870s, 1880s. So I'll start with those and kind of follow it out and supplement that with research in the census materials. Very important, obviously, to figure out kind of who's there now. You know, websites, Wikipedia, it's an okay place. You know, it's not the place to the place to end, you know, but it certainly helps to, you know, corroborate things elsewhere. So that's become, I sort of haunt that place. I haunt the Humanities Room and really enjoy it up there. Good staff and great materials.
Now, this is a really big question, which, I mean, it, in many ways, it's your entire work. But when you think about Milwaukee, especially, mm-hmm. and maybe Wisconsin as a state, are there overarching themes to our story as Wisconsinites, as Milwaukeeans?
Boy, yes. People ask sometimes what makes Milwaukee different, and I always cite three things: Germanism, socialism, and beer. You know, and they're related. A lot of the same ethnic roots for all three of them. And in Wisconsin, the ethnic patterns are somewhat the same. There has been a less a minority presence, you know, than in Milwaukee. Certainly African American, Latino are very important to the story of Milwaukee and have been, you know, from the very beginning. But the progressive tradition in the Wisconsin as a whole is very much analogous to the socialist tradition in Milwaukee. And Milwaukee for a long time, and Wisconsin, they were both kind of laboratories of democracy. And, you know, that has been an overarching theme in our history. And we have departed from that tradition at our peril. I think it is still there subconsciously in sort of a latent form. And I hope sincerely we get back to it because that certainly is a very constructive part of our tradition. Another pattern, though, that overarching in terms of both city and state is the diversity of the population. And that ranges from the number of Native American reservations we have here and the variety of tribes who are present here to the presence of, you know, kind of those pairings of groups who have come here from the beginning, early on Yankee, then German-Irish, Polish-Italian, African-American, Latino, and they're all here. They're all here. So in a critical mass, don't always get along as well as you would hope. And certainly there are in Milwaukee especially entrenched patterns of poverty that have led to entrenched patterns of segregation. Very much like what's going on in sister cities from Cleveland to Buffalo, as we saw, you know, just a couple of weeks ago, to Chicago. But pretty much a northern industrial pattern. But diversity, I've always thought, is it may be inconvenient in some ways because they're not all like us, but that's good stuff. I think it's important to realize that, you know, we belong in a world that, you know, is not just, you know, our voices, our cultures, our histories. I think that's really important. And you know, all three of my kids went to MPS school, so they were raised with, you know, a broader conception of who was here than I was.
Yeah. Well, John Gerda, thank you so much for all of your work. I can't even imagine how frequently you've talked to not just reporters from WUWM, but from all over Milwaukee and Wisconsin. And we really appreciate your work.
Oh, thank you, Joy. It's been a pleasure.
Historian John Gerda is the author of several books on Milwaukee history, including The Making of Milwaukee, Milwaukee City of Neighborhoods, and his most recent, Milwaukee, a City Built on Water. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers about the recent profile of him, which is featured in this month's Milwaukee Magazine. We will take a short break and then return with a conversation about the city's first LGBTQ inclusion clinic. Lake Effect Weekend continues with that on Milwaukee's NPR right after this. We are back with more of Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. There are more than 100 medical specialties. However, few providers and clinics focus their care on the LGBTQ community. LGBT community health centers operate in only 37 of the 50 states, and many of those don't offer comprehensive services. Last summer, the Frederick and Medical College of Wisconsin Inclusion Health Clinic became the first in the region to offer an outpatient program that was tailored to the full range of healthcare needs of the LGBTQ community. Dr. Andrew Petrol is an associate professor at the Medical College of Wisconsin, and he's the medical director of the Inclusion Clinic. He sat down with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski last July to explain why Frederick and the Medical College took the lead to provide this kind of care.
The LGBTQ population faces a number of health disparities, and there's a few reasons why that is. One is that oftentimes people in this community may avoid healthcare settings because either they themselves or people that they know have had some bad experiences with healthcare, so they'll avoid it and they may suffer some consequences from that. And on the other hand, there are certain health conditions that are more prevalent in this population, which really need kind of preventive care or screening. And so that's another reason that if we want to improve the health of this community, we want to provide a place where we can give people a welcoming and affirming environment and also the expertise that they need to get health care that will improve their overall health and outcomes.
We'll get to the specifics of health and outcome related to the LGBT community. But first off, I'm curious, what is the current status quo for LGBTQ care in the medical field across most medical providers? Because I assume that's a big reason why some people stay away from the doctors.
Sure. I think that there's a wide variety of experiences that patients report after seeking health care. Some of them are good and some of them are not so good. There was a study that was done a few years ago by the Williams Institute, and they asked questions like, were you ever refused care that you needed, or were you treated poorly? And they even asked a question about, were you treated physically, roughly, during a clinic visit? And, you know, kind of a shocking number of people report that almost 10% of transgender patients reported that they were treated in a physically abusive way in a healthcare setting. But in a broader sense, I think sometimes people just don't know where they can find care that they'll feel comfortable with. And sometimes they may feel comfortable, but they might maybe missing out on some of the aspects of care that they need. So I think it's a mixed picture.
I know doctors overall vow to do no harm, but I'm wondering, are there specific policies related to LGBTQ patients that are across the board? You know, different states have different legal discriminations right now. Nothing is across the board followed by every state. So are there certain policies within the medical system that can change from provider to provider?
Sure. So I think you're right to say that there are no kind of uniform policies to protect people from different types of discrimination. One of the things that is out there to promote better policies is to seek status with a healthcare equality index, which is an index done by the HRC, Human Rights Campaign. And so Frederick and the Medical College of Wisconsin sought leadership status with that group starting in 2014. And what that status means is that we had to ensure that our policies regarding our own employees, visitors to the hospital or facilities, as well as our patients, have policies that cover them for non-discrimination from our hospital and from our providers. There's also elements of the types of care that you provide that we need to have to get that status. And so we've attained that status in 2014 and have maintained it ever since each year.
So this has been a long-term goal to be a leader in this field.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So what are the primary needs of LGBTQ patients and why have they not been properly addressed by the medical field? You mentioned there's more preventative care involved.
Sure. So, I mean, each person has their own kind of medical needs. And in this population, there are certain types of screening tests which may be more appropriate or certain types of preventive measures like vaccinations or certain medications. One example would be that men who have sex with men need additional vaccines like hepatitis A and HPV vaccines, which aren't routinely given to the general population. And there are certain elements of the LGBT population which have higher rates of things like STDs and HIV. So you would want to screen that population more often for those tests.
For some patients, the consequences of avoiding care sometimes outweigh a potential bad experience they might get at the clinic. So with the clinic and the doctors, what kind of experience or training do the staff receive who will be stationed here?
Sure. So all of the healthcare providers that are part of the clinic have years, and in some cases, with some of us, decades of experience providing care to the LGBTQ community. So that longstanding experience is one important aspect of it. But certainly there are people on our staff who haven't been involved in healthcare that long. And what we've done is done standardized training from national organizations, and we've also brought in trainers directly to do one-on-one sessions with our staff so that they understand some of the nuances of talking with LGBTQ patients when they come to our clinic, so that we will indeed have a very welcoming and affirming environment for our patients.
One thing that is important overall for anyone in their life is having a good primary care doctor, and then for women, having a good OBGYN. And many people will report, such as in that study, that they can't find a good OBGYN that they're comfortable with. So in addition to OB services, what other kinds of services will the clinic provide?
Sure. So, you know, we bill this as what we call comprehensive primary care, which can mean different things for different people. So we know that OBGYN care is important. So some of our primary care providers on our staff are very well versed in that type of care. But we also have an OBGYN provider in our group at the clinic. Our providers will also be able to do gender-affirming hormone therapy for transgender patients, and also to provide HIV treatment and also medication for HIV prevention, which is also called PrEP. Our clinic will also have an endocrinologist as well as a psychiatrist who will do both psychiatric medication and psychotherapy.
With so many services included in one, are there any efforts by Frater to also accept as many insurance policies as possible? Because I know a lot of these treatments, many people would have to accept the fact that either they can't do it or they have to pay out of pocket for certain things like family planning or something else.
Sure. So as far as insurance, you know, our system will take any insurance that allows people to come to us, which is most insurances. And we know that for the different variety of conditions that we'll see people for, there are lots of times some navigation that we'll have to do to help people get the care that they need. And we'll do that to the full extent that we can. And some systems have ways to maneuver through and get certain aspects of care covered, and others kind of have a permanent roadblock. And, you know, we plan to work with patients as best we can to get through those things.
What kind of effect do you hope this clinic can have, not just for the local LGBTQ community, but on other healthcare providers and services?
Sure. So we've gotten a lot of great reactions already to the announcement of the clinic. We've had a lot of healthcare providers express interest in being part of it already, including both the nursing staff and other physicians at our organization. And, you know, graduates of our medical school have gone elsewhere for their training who have heard about it and may be interested in coming back and being part of it. But I think in general, just raising awareness that this population sometimes is not treated well in healthcare settings, and demonstrating how to do it well amongst our colleagues in the rest of our system and the rest of the community, I think is good for everybody.
So you can make an announcement that'll pique people's interest, but how do you establish that trust with the patients who will be coming to your clinic to want to return?
We hope that every part of the experience is welcoming to our patients from the first time that they call to make an appointment. And from then on, of course, their experience when they get to the clinic and have their appointment. And following the appointments, it's standard for our health system and most to survey patients. But we're planning to do more extensive surveying or actual qualitative questioning of patients after their visits with us on the phone or in person if they're interested, to get their feedback. Because we want to do kind of continuous quality improvement to make sure that this clinic is absolutely a wonderful and positive experience for our patients.
In addition to the staff being of importance and the patient experience, what is the importance of involving the Medical College of Wisconsin and the students and the people who are going to be graduating out of there to pique their interest in going into a field such as this?
Absolutely. So in general, training on the subject of LGBT health is not great in medical schools overall in the U.S. and Canada. There was a survey that evaluated that a few years ago and found that in the 4 years of medical school training, that the average number of hours spent on LGBTQ health was 5 hours in the 4 years. And I think actually these days students are very interested in this topic. We've already had a number of students who've heard about the clinic, both at MCW and at other medical schools, approach us and ask if they can rotate with us and get more experience. But one of the reasons that I think that these types of clinics belong in academic medical centers is to provide the opportunity for our learners, which at MCW include medical students and pharmacy students, as well as residents training in a broad variety of specialties. And so we hope to use the clinic to provide them experience in LGBT healthcare so that they can finish their training and go on to provide excellent care to this population after they're done.
I'm curious, are there any other clinics or schools across the U.S. that you've based your model on or improved upon?
There are a relatively small number of LGBTQ-oriented clinics at academic medical centers. There are a few, and we did consult with a few people that we know doing similar things. But ours is a bit different in that we have kind of a multidisciplinary team in our clinic, which is a bit different and provides a little bit more broad care than others that we've spoken with.
Which I imagine is a greater strength compared to, say, a public health center that can serve the LGBTQ community. It won't have the same resources, obviously, as a clinic would.
Right. I mean, we have all these types of specialists at our disposal and in our institution. So we really wanted to leverage that and provide kind of the broadest level of coverage. And we think that the team we've assembled so far will provide the vast majority of healthcare needs. And we'll also plan to examine when we need to refer people to other specialists and then add those specialists to our team when it's necessary.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming in to talk about it today.
Great. Thank you very much.
Dr. Andrew Petrol is an associate professor at the Medical College of Wisconsin, and he's the medical director of the Frederick and Medical College Inclusion Clinic. We first spoke with him last summer. You can find out more information about the clinic and the services that it offers at WUWM.com. We will take one last break and then head to Jewish Museum Milwaukee for Art and the Circus. Lake Effect Weekend continues with that in a moment, right here on Milwaukee's NPR. We are back with more of Lake Effect Weekend here on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North. It's great to have you with us. Jewish Museum Milwaukee recently opened Chagall's Le Cirque. It's the first time the complete collection of Marc Chagall's 23 color and 15 black and white circus theme lithographs have been shown here. The collection is showcased along with objects from Wisconsin's extensive circus history. Chagall was one of the 20th century's most celebrated artists. His work is colorful and exuberant and very deeply human. And we're fortunate today to have his granddaughter, Bella Meyer, in the studio with us. She's joined by Spike Barkin, whose father was one of the founders of Milwaukee's Great Circus Parade. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.
Well, this is such a pleasure for two reasons. One, I love the circus. And two, I love your grandfather's paintings. I have been a fan of Chagall's work for as long as I can remember. And so just the honor of having that work here is amazing. And I guess I want to start with the work itself, and then we'll pull in the circus. Bella, when you look at this work from relatively late in your grandfather's life, what do you feel? How do you feel when you look at that work?
Well, it's actually quite astonishing a feeling I have each time, especially when I feel close to something or I like one of his works, which is most of the time. It's as if my whole body starts to vibrate. It makes me happy. It makes me happy, and I feel like going into the image, into the drawing, the painting, the lithograph. I recognize his gestures. I recognize his love for humanity. It's just quite formidable and an experience each time.
It sounds like it brings you closer to him in some ways.
That's right. I feel very close to him. It's more that I recognize the connections. I recognize him in this dot, in that dot, in this face. So it's more like that, because I really truly always feel very close and very personally involved in his work.
Spike, is this the first time you've seen this work up close and personal?
The Circus Suite, yes, absolutely.
And so what is your impression of it as somebody coming from a sort of a circus world?
Well, I've found the exhibition amazing. I've always liked Chagall, but these pieces in particular are just fabulous. There's one that I'd like to take off the wall and take home with me.
There's
many, but you got to be, you know, can't be...
Leave one or two for somebody else.
Right.
Yeah.
I can't be, you know, too piggy about it. But there's one piece where one of the handlers of the horses is in the stalls and he's about to feed the horses. And there are four or five horses, each different color, their heads. And the expressions on the horses is so warm and wonderful that it just sort of reminded me of what it was like on the circus grounds. Before the circus parade, they would have a circus and they would hold all the horses and all the animals on the circus grounds near the lakefront. And we would always walk through those and just see the animals, and it was fabulous. And this just sort of brought all that back, and the sort of the warmth that is depicted in Chagall's work of these horses is fabulous.
What is it about circus, do you think, that captivates human beings? What is it about this art form? And I think it is an art form.
It keeps you young. I mean, really, the kids love it. I remember when I was growing up in Milwaukee, I must have been 6 or 7, and the circus would come to Milwaukee, and we had tickets to go, and it was 105 outside. So who knew what it was inside that tent? Because they didn't have air conditioning in those days in the tents. And my mom said, "We can't go. It's just too hot." And I said, "I don't care. I want to go to the circus." And it, for adults, I think it brings out the kid in you once again, because you sort of remember and reflect about that and the magic of the circus. The circus acts, the animals, the clowns, every aspect of it is geared to just sheer enjoyment.
Well, I think that's also what links Chagall and the circus so much, or the Chagall world and the circus world. Myself also, I'm like you, Spike, or like you, always loved the circus. I also always loved my grandfather's work. And because both of these worlds bring out the most innocent of truth. And there is no second guessing. My grandfather would say it's all comes out of his heart. And indeed, the circus world, as we known it when we were little, and I mean, I've grown up just with the one ring and the very simple but impeccable performances of each of these wonderful artists in the ring. And it brings you back to whom you really are. So it brings you back to your inner child. And the child, your child, your children, or when we were children, we didn't have to be brought back. We just welcomed it all. My grandfather was always kept this innocence of welcoming the world in its best and in its most beautiful, in its most joyful of moments, and was able to translate it and to give it back to the world.
There's something about his work and the circus. It's the color. It's the sound, it's the smells of the various things, and it does seem to bring you into the moment right now.
Yes. Yeah.
And you don't need anything else
That's
for
right.
that moment.
Yes.
In looking at this work, and Spike, looking back at working on the circus grounds and presenting that for the time that you and your family were a part of it, do we have anything now that compares?
In Milwaukee?
Oh, in the world.
In the world?
Yeah.
It's something that was so unique to this community. The last circus parade was typical of what had gone on before, and the different elements that were brought to this event in Milwaukee was just sheer joy. And I don't think there is anything that really compares for the totality of what was going on. In 1965, 2 years after the first parade, which was then called A Day in Old Milwaukee, but in 1965, they started to use the circus train by bringing the circus wagons from the Baraboo Circus World Museum to Milwaukee. On the train had flatbed cars, and they would put the wagons on those cars. And these wagons were works of art. They were 100-year-old circus wagons gathered around from all over the world, actually. And on that train ride, which was the first real exciting element of the entire week-long celebration, and on the train, as you would go through the various cities and towns, people would line the tracks with their kids watching this train go by. And the sheer joy of expression from those families seeing this was amazing. And eventually the route went through Illinois so that more people could experience it, and it would come into the lakefront and drop off the wagons. It was fabulous. So that was one element. The other element was the activities that were on the circus grounds, and they had a circus. They had different acts that were going on. People could walk around and get really close up to the wagons to see them. And then there was the circus parade itself, which was a unique event. It recreated the old circus parades from the turn of the century. But before the parade, there were activities that went on. People created their own setup as far as lining the streets with seats to watch the parade. And for days before, there was one area right at the beginning of the parade near the War Memorial where a bunch of people created Barkinville, which they named after my dad. And these people would set up overnight. They would set up tents. They would set up little barbecue pits. It was like a little community within the community. And they even had names. I think there was Tova Street and Ernie Boulevard or something. And they just created this whole atmosphere of enjoying what was going on. And I know that my dad would always stop there every year and say hello to everybody and that. And it was just such warmth and just the generosity of goodwill and spirit and happiness that really permeated that whole event.
You know, Bela, I was sitting here listening to Spike and thinking, wouldn't it have been wonderful if your grandfather had been able to paint that?
Yes, it would have been extraordinary. But also, he did paint it. He did paint it with his own memories, with his own things he saw. And that's why your question of does something like the circus parade still exists or exists somewhere else? And no, it most likely doesn't. But thank goodness there are and there will always be the most generous people, artists or producers, musicians or jugglers who will want to give this warmth and joy to the community. So that will always exist. So I think even if the circus parade doesn't exist now in Milwaukee, I mean, the memories exist and this show is absolutely extraordinary to show it. But then also Chagall's work will always be around to be able to repeat that same or similar enchantment for anybody to see if they want so. And then there are concerts, musicians, improvised moments everywhere. I mean, in New York, just 2 days ago in New York, I came upon a remodeled bus with young musicians on top of the roof and singing and playing music, and it was extraordinary. It was extraordinary to see the people around.
It had that circus feel,
yes.
Even though it
yes.
wasn't the circus. Yeah,
I
think, you know, the circus has changed so much. You know, places like Cirque du Soleil still have that, and you know, there aren't any animals anymore, but they do the wonderful acrobatics and they
yes.
do that sort of thing. So it lives on in different places and in different ways. But I think you're right, Bella. I think it's that impromptu people getting together
word, yeah.
to create joy.
Yes.
And that kind of goes back to that old-fashioned idea of the circus,
yes.
I think, you know, of taking you in that moment and just letting you, you know, experience that.
Mm-hmm.
I know this exhibition is up through the summer. Spike, what, besides the video of the last circus parade here, what else is there from Milwaukee circus history and Wisconsin circus history?
Oh, there's an extensive exhibition of the history of the circus in Wisconsin. It's really well documented. It's just fascinating. And that's when you walk into the museum, that's what's on display. And they have pieces from many collections of the circus parade itself, but also the Circus World Museum has lent various incredible objects from circuses and banners and posters and stuff. So there's a lot to see about the history of the circus and the circus parade at this exhibit. And then after you walk through that, you walk down an aisle of posters, and then you walk into the rooms that have the Chagall suite of the circus. And there's also a video of Chagall talking about his creations. And it's a really well put together exhibition. It's really impressive.
You know, one thing that I didn't bring up, and I should, is the fact that this is taking place in a Jewish museum. Of course, your grandfather, you are Jewish. What is the connection of Jewish life and circus?
It's very close. One of the aspects of the circus, of the circus act, is that Chagall, I think, always perceived it as something very spiritual. And he came from a Hasidic family. He comes from a place where the Chabad was born. So the most, in a way, joyful of people of that particular group of Jews, they wanted to, how do you say, maybe simplify or bring the Torah and the laws and the traditions to all people. They very much believed that it was an intellectual re-questionings which would bring you closer to God, but it was the joy which would bring your belief and celebrating the holiness of what you believed in. And so dancing was a major part of the ritual, even clownliness or making fun, not just at Purim, but in all holidays, was very much part of it. So he was very much aware of that aspect. But in his town and all over Russia, but also in the Pale of Settlement where the Jews were allowed to be, circus people came in and out all the time. That's how they tried to survive, make money, and find a way of expressing themselves.
And so the connection is very, very close.
Very close, yes. Yeah. Yes. But he was maybe, he was more affected by them than his siblings, for instance. He would always go out and see them and seek them out.
And you can see that in his works, that exuberance of color and movement. And even in works that aren't specifically about the circus, you can feel that.
That's
that
right.
That joy.
Yes, yes, yes. Very
in his
much
work.
So.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, I want to thank both of you for taking time to come in. It has been such an honor. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. It was a really great honor.
Bella Meyer is the granddaughter of the artist Marc Chagall. Spike Barkin is the son of Ben Barkin, one of the founders of Milwaukee's Great Circus Parade. The exhibit, Chagall's Le Cirque, is on display at Jewish Museum Milwaukee through early September. There is more information at WUWM.com. And that wraps up the show today. I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. All Things Considered comes your way next, so stay tuned. It's 4 o'clock.